Well, with projections that show that Utah's population will nearly double from today's 2.9 million people to 5.4 million people by the year 2050, the Your Utah, Your Future survey was designed for Utahns to create a vision for their state for the next 35 years. Survey participants chose between five overall scenarios, with each scenario proposing a set of choices for the 11 specific issues, which ranged from water to transportation to recreation. The results of those surveys have been released over the last several months. Most recently, the results from the jobs and economy questions. On the phone to discuss those, I have the CEO of Envision Utah, which undertook the survey, Robert Groh. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, Leslie. Thanks for inviting me.
So the most recent results about jobs and the economy are in. Are these the final results, or are there still more to come?
There are actually more to come. So this is the final one of the 11 topics. So there's sort of a vision being created by the public on each of the 11 topics, but then we will release an overall vision which combines the 11 topics on at what we call the Common Good Awards launch on October 26th with the governor.
All right. And then, I mean, what happens with these final recommendations? I mean, they just get distributed to lawmakers, to whom?
No state, no region has ever had this kind of response from the public. So first thing I'd like to say is thanks to almost 53,000 Utahns who took the extensive survey online. And those results are being given to legislators, the governor's office, local leaders, mayors, city councils, and so on. Utahns, I think, have clearly defined the kind of future they'd like. And so I think everybody's intrigued with this as they see the results roll out.
So you learned that jobs and the economy, the number one concern for Utahns, even more than water. Any guesses why?
Well, I think it's a very personal issue as well as an issue for all of us together. Jobs and economy really says, can I have a good job? Can I support my family? Will my children be able to get a good job? Will they be able to stay here with me? The dominant value among Utahns, as we've surveyed the in-depth emotional reasons they care about things, the number one value is a safe, secure place for their family, which includes a great education and having their children have the opportunity to stay in Utah. So we're not surprised that jobs and economy came out number one and that education was close to that. Water and air were both up there right behind jobs and economy because they're what I would call the two big showstoppers about our future.
Certainly businesses will be attracted to Utah because of cheap energy costs or low taxes, traffic that's not nearly as bad as it is in many locations, and relatively clean air. But certainly doesn't all of that change when we bring more people into the state? And it doesn't seem like Utahns are concerned about that.
Actually, Utahns are pro-growth because over the years they've seen that the economy's grown, their families, their children, the ability to get a good job here has increased significantly over time. If you look at the scenarios that were presented to the public that were developed by over 400 experts working for over 2 years as our choices, there are good answers on every topic. But we can't accommodate that growth if we do the right thing, but only if we do the right thing. So the public got educated on those choices and helped deliver their view there, how they would make the decisions about the future. So on air quality, there's no question we can have clean air along the Wasatch Front and back if we just focus on doing the right things from here on out.
Well, as I kind of read through the survey results, I mean, it seemed a bit hypocritical to me. I mean, that is, the respondents say that we want an educated workforce, but we're not willing to pay more taxes for education, or at least we haven't seen that in the state legislature. We say we want good air quality, but no one's willing to shut down the coal industry and go to renewable sources. We say we want affordable housing, but not in my backyard. So if Utahns are saying this is the future vision of the state, but now won't walk the talk, then, I mean, how do we implement the future that Utahns say they want?
Yeah, well, I think if you look at those specific topics and how the public answered, the public recognized that coal is going away and picked a base that had significantly more renewables as well as natural gas to give us a firm, secure, and energy base for the future. So they do see those changes coming in all the scenarios. There was no conceivable scenario where there would be any significant coal-fired power in Utah by 2050. So I'm just using that is an example of where Utah said, we see this change coming, it's going to occur, we want more renewables, but we also want a stable, secure place. With respect to education, it was very interesting that the scenario the public picked actually, as its base, that we would apply 5% more a year for 5 years to education of the state's budget. In other words, just like the legislation the governor did last year, they took much of the surplus and applied it to education. This would say do that over the next five additional years so that we substantially increase the funding for targeted, specific strategies we know will make a difference, like early childhood education, better training for teachers, higher pay, making college more affordable, making sure that we understand how each child is doing so we can intervene and help them if necessary. Those are key strategies the public essentially endorsed by picking the scenario. And the scenario they picked said that we would pay more, we would take the surplus, but if that wasn't enough, we would actually raise taxes. And the public chose that. So when you ask them in the abstract, are you willing to pay additional taxes for education? They're willing, somewhat willing or slightly willing, a majority of them. But they're saying, tell us what you're going to do with the money. But when you give them specifics, the strategy that shows that they are willing to pay more.
So, you know, and then you have that information, and then you go to the Utah Taxpayers Association, and they're like, hell no.
Well, you know, legislation, how we apply the state budget is always a tussle up there on the Hill. They'll be up there again doing it. They're planning now, and they'll be up there, you know, looking at the governor's proposed budget in just a couple of months. And I think this is an important outcome that the public has said. Jobs and economy is number one, but education is the key driver of that. Yes, we have to have clean air. Yes, we have to have great recreation. But we view the education system and our workforce as the key issue about jobs and economy. And they also said, we want everybody to be educated so we have great communities where people can all get a job, where people recognize each other for their skills and what they bring so that people can be better citizens. So there's a very strong tie in the survey between education and jobs and economy.
Yeah. And back to your statement where, you know, you say that Utahns are pro-growth. If Utahns want these higher paying quality jobs and the state continues to be a hotbed for economic development,
right,
we're willing to trade the traffic and the lack of, the air quality. And again, more kids in the education system. So any kind of tax increase still is maybe not keeping up. I mean, so people are willing to trade those high jobs and for, you know, fewer places to recreate, lesser air quality, less water to deal with.
Well, the challenge with growth is that people are coming here because they like it. They think we have a great quality of life here, and so we have to preserve and protect that quality of life. And so if you look across all the topics, Utahns said we need to make sure we do the best at preserving the things we love. And here are the strategies we would choose to do that. So if you look at recreation, for example, they said we've got to fund an increase in capacity of our systems. Right now, we're still working with many of the same trails and other places, campgrounds that we had 20 years ago. And the public's saying, don't get behind, keep up. And so the public is concerned about the growth, but they are also responding, we're in favor of growth if we do the right things on these topics. And so the public is actually really smart about this. They live in the traffic we create. They struggle to get the recreation they would like in their lives. And so they have very clear views, and it's an intelligent response I think we got as people look towards the future. So I think it's important that we recognize that jobs and economy is number one because it allows their families to stay. It drives a stronger opportunity to support their families and the other people they love. It provides the opportunity to do other things in their lives. And they see growth as a contributor to that. There's perhaps, you know, if you were to pull these statistics all apart, maybe 15 to 20% of Utahns would shut the door. But when you do that, you pull the plug on the economic growth as well. Now, no place has ever stayed stable at a certain population we want to have those kind of jobs, the growth is going to continue.
Any other findings kind of jump out at you as you reviewed the latest here?
Yeah. I don't think it's surprising that jobs and economy is number one, but they understand, the public clearly understands, that takes a great education system. We've got to substantially improve it. We've got to fund it more. We've got to make sure the strategies we implement will really be successful and we stick with them. But they also want the air to be clean. They want to make sure that we conserve quite a bit of water and delay having to build larger projects for a period of years. They want to make sure we increase our food supply. They're thinking intelligently about the whole range of issues. That's what's been fun about this is most regional visions, most efforts to look at the future look at three or four topics. By tackling 11 at a time, we've got a much clearer picture of what Utahns want. So stay tuned. The release of the overall vision will be in about October 26th. So we're getting close.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to you kind of as that final follow-up there. In the meantime, how can people find out more about the results that you've already posted?
Just go to envisionutah.com, envisionutah.com, or envisionutah.org, and all the full results on each of these topics as they've been released are posted there. So anybody can read those. If they still want to take the survey, it's still live at envisionutah.org.
Great.
They can see exactly all the questions people looked at, and they go take the survey still.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, what you're up to like 50, almost nearly 53,000 people, huh?
Yeah, our goal was 50,000. We had, when we started counting numbers and analyzing, we were at 52,845 at midnight on May 31st. But people are continuing to take the survey, so we're really excited because it's a real opportunity to learn what 400 experts said our choices were, not what the right answer was, but to give the public a range of choices so they can see, if we do these strategies, these are the projected outcomes. And we ought to be optimistic about the future. When we started this effort in 1998, said we're going to have 1 million people by 2020, people were freaking out over the million people. Well, they're almost all here now. And we've done pretty well at accommodating them, but we do need some course corrections and to be better at some of the things we're doing.
Okay. Robert Groh is the CEO of Envision Utah. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:29. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Joining me now in the studio, Park City Council Member Andy Bierman. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's talk first about the Alice claim. Basically, you took a field trip, you had a look at the new plat, and then said this should be before Planning Commission.
Yeah, it came to us in work session, which was a little bit unusual. It wasn't. Planning Commission a few weeks ago had unanimously denied the Alice claim proposal, and this was actually a different proposal, one that they had been working on back in 2009 that they brought in front of council. And I believe it was basically to take our temperature and see if they should move forward with that. We couldn't really, having been fresh for council, the Planning Commission's been working on this for years and spent probably a dozen or more meetings studying it. It was new for council, so we took a look at it. We said on the surface that this plan looks better, but this needs to go through the appropriate process, which is the Planning Commission, and see it through with them.
Yeah, Chairman of the Planning Commission, Adam Strong, last night suggested that the applicant, by bringing a new plan to the council, maybe trying to sidestep the Planning Commission, or was that just the way, is that just how the process works?
It's unusual, let's put it that way. I asked Mark Harrington, our city attorney, whether it was appropriate process, and he said yes, the applicant does have the ability to do that. So there was a little bit of confusion there, but in the end, I think it ended up where it should, which is back at the Planning Commission.
Yeah. What about the applicant's claims about how long this has taken?
Well, I think when I was very first new on council, Charlie Windsor was still our chair of the Planning Commission, and he said something to me which I've really seen to come true, which he said, all the easy projects have been solved and done by now, Andy. The only things left are these very complicated projects in Old Town that are infill or in difficult locations with soils issues or access issues. And that's what we're seeing. Alice Claim is a very complicated project on a couple of levels. There was environmental cleanup. It's on substandard streets. It's in mature neighborhoods, and it's near ridgeline. So sorting through all this is not going to be easy.
Yeah. So is the applicant still trying to work with the landowner that would allow him to get easier access so that we don't have to build the 60-foot-tall retaining walls?
I hope so. He said he is still working with the landowner. He said he's had very little progress on that, so he's coming at us with a proposal for the road. But I would hope that eventually he'd be able to sort out the access in a manner that is lower impact. And I think there's a big financial incentive on his part. I can't imagine building that road and those retaining walls, even if he were granted permission, would be inexpensive.
So it sounds like City Council basically withholding comment on what they think about the gully plan until it comes back to you after it's been seen by the Planning Commission?
Yeah, we're not really qualified at this point to judge. Like I said, this was fresh in front of us, and there are so many layers to this. I think Councilwoman Simpson pointed out that if they were coming to council to expedite the process, we're the wrong people, because it would take multiple meetings and a lot of studying for us to get up to speed.
All right. Mountain Accord currently considering various names for the Forest Service lands within the Mountain Accord boundary, monument, conservation. But you're staying out of the debate because none of it's in Summit County, or what?
No, we're not staying out of the debate. It was really just we're coming in front of council to get a quick read to see if any of the council members were passionate about a particular name. Mountain Accord is getting ready to submit some federal legislation for additional protections of the Wasatch. And we've agreed upon all the elements of that, what those protections are going to look like, what the boundaries are going to be. But we're struggling on a title. And because it's such a controversial thing, I personally think a national monument is the best fit as a title, in terms of it gives us the flexibility, the funding, some potential brand cachet. However, that is so controversial in Utah. My understanding is there isn't the political will, I think, to go forward with that title. So what we're likely going to hear is an all-new designation called the Central Wasatch National Conservation and Recreation Area. I think it's a mouthful, but at the end of the day, it's really, the book is written. The important part is what's in the bill, and the title is, it has some significance to the various groups that are involved, but I don't think it's the most important element.
Does it matters because of the funding that goes along with it?
Well, with the National Monument, that would potentially give us access to additional funding.
But kind of the Escalante deal? Wrecked it for all?
Monuments? It's stigmatized in Utah, and that continues to go on as a debate. What the Mountain Accord was initially talking about is we can do a congressionally designated national monument. It would not come from the president, so the control would be in the hand of our legislation. And that was one of the ideas on how we could pursue this. Again, personally, I wish we would go that route. I think there's a lot of hard issues we're taking on at the Mountain Accord, and that would be one that we could add to the pile, and I think we could justify it on a lot of levels, but again, there's a lot of strategy that goes into this, and some perhaps wiser than I are suggesting that we not take that fight.
Yeah, you made that good clarification there. I mean, the difference was you're coming to Congress with it as opposed to President Clinton saying this is going to be. So
our state legislatures made it pretty clear to the Mountain Accord that they don't like that name, period. So it would be quite a hill to climb.
All right. And also, you've got an RFP, a request for a proposal out for a program manager, something that Lainey Jones, the current kind of director, can apply for?
Yep.
Or?
Yeah, Lainey's done an outstanding job, and we've encouraged her to apply, but her contract was through phase one, and we are completing phase one. So we need to move on to phase two, which means we have to RFP and look at all the candidates for that.
So if someone's interested, they can find out more on the website or something? Or
That's a great question. The RFP process is going to – we're actually moving that process from UTA over to the Wasatch Front Regional Council. So they will be handling the putting out those RFPs and collecting those, and then the management team for the Mountain Accord will actually be doing the interviews.
All right. During council comments, you heard from council members Tim Henney and Cindy Matsumoto talking about the Historic Park City Alliances and businesses in Old Town, who say that somehow if free market forces are left in play, businesses will not be able to exist on Main Street because of the escalating rents. I mean, can you have a say in that? I mean, that's capitalism, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think affordability is a townwide issue, in terms of we talk about affordability in housing, but it's also an issue for small businesses. And I've seen that firsthand as a small business owner on the street and a landlord, so I've been on both sides of the equation. It's something that the city and the HPCA are looking at together. There's a lot of concern. How do we keep our authenticity, which requires us to not be all chains on the street or maybe necessarily all high-end businesses like galleries and things? We want some mom-and-pop businesses still there. So we don't have an easy answer for that. And we'll continue to work with the HPCA and see what we can come up with.
Right. But again, I mean, it's private property. They can do whatever they want, even if it means shutting it down.
That is the case. There are property rights. There might be the city might have some ability through business licenses or special events permits. We might have a little bit of leverage there. In the past, we have put restrictions on parking and signs that keep the chains off of the street or discourage them, the formula-based businesses. But the city has limited tools.
And so will you investigate that? I mean, are you putting together some task force
Well, I think that's what Tim and Cindy attended was, or I believe Tim attended that one. There is a task force between the HPCA and the city where they're looking at the options here. One other thing that's come up is should the city help do some development on Sweet Alley? I think that's something that Aspen worked with their merchants on. They put in some lower rent spaces in their alleys and their back streets that small businesses could go into.
All right. You also heard from Tony Maples during public comment about the need for a dog park in Old Town, since apparently a lot of people get nabbed with having their dogs off leash. She suggested the little park by the shoe tree. Is that even city property?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if it's city property, and I'm not sure if we've looked at that before. We haven't had a lot of requests for a dog park specifically in Old Town, because I think many people utilize the library field, which is multi-use, as well as they walk their dogs up onto Sweeney's and other areas. I know I'm a resident, and those are my go-to choices. But dog parks are popular, and it's certainly something we don't mind looking into opportunities on.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, though, that any open space that the city has, you would try and reserve for affordable housing or something, no?
Well, there are spaces that are appropriate and there are spaces that aren't. I think we just went through that conversation on the library field and decided that wasn't appropriate for affordable housing, but it was great for multi-use gathering space. And one of those uses tends to be dogs.
All right. You also heard that she walks her dog on Poison Creek. And again, more and more skateboarders and mountain bikers speeding by, threatening her and her dog's safety.
Yeah.
Is the city going to jump in on this?
Well,
are you leaving up to Mount Charlie?
Yeah, that's a great question for Charlie. But I will say, as somebody that frequently uses the city's trails, that one is one of high use. And as a biker, I usually skirt it. I go down Deer Valley Drive, which has its own hazards, or Park Avenue. Personally, I would like to see us put a path in parallel to Deer Valley Drive on the Marriott and the park side. There's a big grassy area, and maybe divert the bikes over to there. That's something I've suggested that Heinrich take a look at, and maybe they'll come back to us with some solutions there, or maybe there are alternatives. I'm not a big fan of signing it with speed signs and that, because I just don't think people will listen. I mean, Charlie gets at the heart of it, where he's like, we just need to be more patient and kinder with our other trail users. If we don't have fundamental manners, it doesn't matter what we post.
Yeah, but you're not going to go so far as to build speed bumps or what was the other thing, like gullies or something, right?
I personally wouldn't recommend it. I'm not sure where council will go with it.
Okay. And then finally, there was some discussion with regard to making the dog poo trail, as many of us know, that walks from right hillside up to Prospect. A paved trail or?
It was brought up in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, if that could be enhanced or there could be a way to bring people down. And so it came back in a manager's report, and there didn't seem to be, the staff recommendation was that was a low priority compared to our other walkability issues. I was the only one that brought it up, and I thought that we should put a slightly enhanced trail in there. Right now it's just a goat trail and it's pretty eroded. And I thought we could put in a soft surface basic trail and see how much it's used, and then we could watch that and perhaps a couple of years from now do something enhanced or more formal if we need. But there didn't seem to be interest in that from council.
Yeah, and maybe a dog baggy dispenser.
Good plan.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
I do want to give leadership had their graduation last night. I think it was class 21 that had their graduation, and they selected their community leadership award for the year, and it was given to Jenny Smith. And I think it was well-deserved. She's been a tremendous community member involved on so many levels. So it was great to see them recognize her.
Great. Okay. Andy, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now. 8:43. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City New Museum has a new exhibit in the studio. With details, I have Park City Museum Director Sandra Morrison. Good morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
So what is it?
So our new exhibit is called Plastics Unwrapped. And, you know, something new, completely different. We've heard Recycle Utah talk about plastics for years. So this is the community's opportunity to come and find out exactly, you know, what are the issues here? What's the history? Because, of course, it explores the history. Before the 1950s, we hardly used plastics at all. And, you know, if you, those of us that are old enough can think back or, you know, we read in historical novels, I mean, people didn't have Gore-Tex raincoats. They had oil skins. So there's a lot of exploration into, you know, what did we used to do. And then it just explores how plastics has changed our lives, affected our health and the environment, good and bad. Yeah.
So is this one of those traveling exhibits
yes.
that you were just able to get your hands on?
Yeah, or? So it came from the Burke Museum, which is at Washington State University. In Washington, yeah, and we have it. We opened on October 3rd, and we'll have it on exhibit until January 1st.
All right. Museum hours or what?
So we're right now. We're open from 10 until 7, and then in the middle of this month we'll switch to a shorter 11 to 6 hours, and you can find that on our website. And we're also doing a free day. Next Tuesday, and that's October 13th, and generously supported by Leland and Diana Swanner. And so we'll be open from 10 in the morning until 7 at night. So come on by and explore plastics.
Okay. What else have you got in the museum going on?
So the other thing we're going to do with plastics is partner with the film series and Recycle Utah, and we're showing a documentary called Plastic Paradise, and that is in, I think it's November 5th. And it's underwritten by Linda McReynolds. And that is actually a documentary exploring, it's called The Great Pacific Garbage Patch, that the way the Pacific Ocean moves, the plastics are being consolidated in it in the area of the Midway Atoll, which we all remember from World War II. So that should be a fascinating documentary.
Okay. Again, Plastics Unwrapped is open at the Park City Museum. Locals Free Day is coming up October 13th.
13th, yeah, next Tuesday.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sandra, thanks. KPCW News Time now, 8:52. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as we've reported, the Utah Public Service Commission held a public hearing last night to take input on a request from Rocky Mountain Power to allow a surcharge on its solar customers. One of those who thinks it's a bad idea is John Conde. He's with Alpenglow Solar. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. So I was going to say, of course you're against it because it means perhaps a loss in business?
Yeah, we're concerned about it because we feel that the industry is still in its fledgling portion of things. And it's a really, really small portion of overall Rocky Mountain Power customers that are supporting and using solar systems. And we'd like to see it grow. We have a tremendous opportunity and potential here in the state. And we're one of the dirtiest utilities out there with all the coal that we use, and we see it in our air.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about the numbers, do you have any idea what the percentage
is? I don't know what the actual percentage is. There's roughly 3,000 residential installations in the state, which is pretty small in the overall customers. I know we are gaining on some of our commercial size systems. There was a little over 100-megawatt system that's scheduled to come online in the southern part of the state. I think by the end of the year. So that's down by the Parowan area, somewhere in that area. So,
but not every area is good for solar. And I mean, so it's like if we got sun like we do, I mean, some 300 days a year, right?
Yeah,
it's a good thing.
We have a tremendous solar resource here in the state. There really isn't any reason for us to not utilize it.
Yeah. I think I had heard just recently that like in San Diego, already 6% of residential customers have solar panels. So I don't know in the scheme of things, but it made it sound like that was a lot.
That is a lot. The thing that's pretty amazing is that nationwide, I think we're approaching 1% of our total amount of electricity. That's it, just 1% total amount of electricity coming from solar. And half of that, by the end of the year, we're going to be around 20 gigawatts worth of solar installed. And nearly half of that is in the state of California.
Yeah. So Rocky Mountain Power, though, says, I mean, they're just asking solar customers to pay their fair share. So isn't that the right thing to do?
I can't disagree with it completely. However, Utah Clean Energy and others have asked Rocky Mountain Power to prove why it is that they feel that we are not, or solar customers not paying their fair share. There is still a connection fee that you cannot get rid of. That is about $9 a month. What does that go towards? I'm assuming it goes towards processing of paperwork, grid maintenance, those kind of things. So we feel like there's still some sort of payment going to Rocky Mountain Power. And if they feel that there is a need, then we'd like it proved, and proved so that it actually is a viable thing. So
yeah, I haven't seen what they have submitted to the Public Service Commission, but apparently they feel like they have done that, because that's why we're back here a second time.
Yeah, the Utah Clean Energy, when they helped defeat or prolong from last year, they asked that they come back with numbers and calculate why it is that they feel that this is needed. The thing that we're running into right now is that they're calculating the short term. And we need to look at this as a long term. These solar systems are warrantied for 25 years. That's the minimum life expectancy. It's not a 1 year thing. And we need a long term look at this and the benefits. You know, that the more solar we put in, the less they're going to have to expand their system. There is actually some reduction in usage on their grid, because we don't have the big utility lines aren't getting used as much, because we're now reducing some of that load. So there's actually some deferred maintenance as well, and there's some deferred expansion, and whenever they expand, that costs them a lot of money.
Yeah. So apparently in Arizona, there was a similar surcharge, and what we had heard was that solar orders basically dried up. What Rocky Mountain Power told me was that wasn't because of the surcharge, but because there was a loss of subsidies.
I'm not completely familiar with it. I think there was a combination of things, but that definitely had its hand in helping to drop the solar industry immensely.
Yeah, but even, I mean, say $2-5 extra a month, you know, that Rocky Mountain Power, and they didn't know what they were asking for, because they don't know what the PSC will give them. But I mean, if you've got enough money to put solar panels on your house, I mean, what's another $5 a month?
Well, I understand that, right? And I don't fully disagree with it. But the point is, from those in the industry, is that prove it. If you just randomly throw in $5, what's to say they're not going to do $20 or $50? It needs to be proved. There needs to be transparency there to tell us why it is that they need this and why this is happening.
All right. How big of a deal are the state and federal tax credits then as part of this? Because those actually are going away too, aren't they?
The state is not. Residentially, the state is, it's fantastic that we have it. It's a fairly small portion of it, because it caps at $2,000, which is a pretty small solar system. The federal is a pretty big deal. It's 30%. That's a $30,000 system. That's $10,000 back. Right now, they're trying to extend it. They've been working on it, those in Washington, D.C. There has been no indication of where it's going to go, but it is scheduled to sunset December 31st of next year, 2016.
Okay. You know, we've also heard about the long delay of getting solar arrays hooked up. Our Rocky Mountain Power says that's because they need to make sure that the systems are properly grounded, or they're just going to cause a lot of havoc. You don't buy that?
I don't buy that completely. To be honest with you, I think everybody's learning and they don't know. I've been trying to do in my very busy, the one thing that's fantastic is the solar industry in the state is absolutely booming. And this is definitely something that's why we're paying attention to it, because it could kill that. But what we're looking at is at pretty much everything that's larger systems, three phase, they're saying they have to be this effective grounding, which is an added cost, an added element, added time to these systems. And there doesn't seem to be any real justification that I can find behind that. They're in their interconnection agreement, it says effective grounding may be required, but they do not say where they got that. If we look into some of the interconnection standards out there, IEEE, I can't remember the actual number of it now, that effective grounding has to do with synchronous generators. It says nothing about solar source inverters. And the solar inverters are all engineered to shut down in the event of faults on the utility side. And so if I go and speak with utility inverters, manufacturers, they're like, why are you doing this? This is a waste of time and money. It's costing the country millions of dollars for something that doesn't even do anything.
Hmm. So you think they're just dragging their feet because just means
I don't know
smaller
if they're,
bills.
Yeah, I don't know if they're dragging their feet on purpose. I don't know whether it's because they don't know how it really will affect. But it does seem like maybe our interconnection agreements need to be revisited. I think they're a bit outdated. And I think that we've learned a lot as an industry and as a utility. There's states out there, Hawaii, for instance, that have way, way more concentration than we do without issues.
Okay, I've got to leave it at that. John, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 9 o'clock.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.